Well, George Whitefield and Oliver Hart. George Whitefield was the key figure in the transatlantic evangelical revival of the 18th century, and Christians throughout the English-speaking world owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude. Today, I want to propose that Southern Baptists, my own particular tribe among the evangelicals, have special reason to give thanks to God for the grand itinerant. Though the Southern Baptist Convention was not founded until 1845, Whitefield profoundly influenced one of its most important forerunners, Oliver Hart. His dates are 1723, same birth year as Samuel Davies, and Hart died in 1795. On this 300th birthday celebration for Whitefield, on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, the time and the place seem right to tell the story of their friendship. But first, who exactly was Oliver Hart? Though he's largely forgotten today, Baptist historian Lully Latimer Owens has pronounced that South Carolina Baptist and Southern Baptist have no more important pioneer than Oliver Hart. It's a bold claim, but it's difficult to contest. As a pastor, Hart shepherded the Baptist Church of Charleston, South Carolina, from 1750 to 1780, establishing that congregation as the mother church of Southern Baptist. Hart was also the chief architect of the Charleston Baptist Association, the first Baptist association of the South, modeled after the Philadelphia Baptist Association. Hart established a ministerial fund, which was the first cooperative effort to fund theological education among Baptists in America. In addition, Hart personally mentored such notable Baptist figures as Samuel Stillman, Edmund Botsford, and Richard Furman, shaping future generations of Baptist leaders in the process. Hart is truly a giant among Baptists, and perhaps no man was more responsible in molding Hart's fruitful and far-reaching ministry than Whitefield. To their story, we now turn, converting Oliver Hart. In the spring of 1740, as Whitefield was barnstorming the middle colonies of America, Oliver Hart was 16 years old. He was a faithful but as yet unconverted attender of the Pennypeck Baptist Church in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Hart's pastor was a Welshman named Jenkin Jones, a dynamic preacher and leader in the Philadelphia Baptist Association. Jenkin Jones would be the key figure in bringing Hart under the sound of Whitefield's gospel. Jones threw Whitefield his full support after their initial meeting in Philadelphia in 1739, and Whitefield spoke admiringly about Jones on several occasions. On May 7th, 1740, Whitefield wrote in his diary, "After dispatching some private affairs, I went and heard Mr. Jones, the Baptist minister, who preached the truth as it is in Jesus. He is the only preacher that I know of in Philadelphia who speaks feelingly and with authority. The poor people are much refreshed by him, and I trust the Lord will bless him more and more," end quote. 2 days after this, Jones invited Whitefield to preach at the Pennypeck Meeting House. That's Oliver Hart's home church, and over 2,000 were in attendance. Though it's not certain that Hart was present on this occasion, it does seem likely. In later life, Oliver Hart often mentioned hearing Whitefield preach and the deep impression that that preaching made on him. Richard Furman, who is Hart's successor at the Charleston Baptist Church, he drew attention to Whitefield's influence on Hart in the memorial sermon that he preached after Oliver Hart died. Furman said that Hart's attention to religion and conversion to God were at an early period is very certain. At that time, the power of religion was greatly displayed in various parts of this continent under the ministry of that eminent servant of Christ, Reverend George Whitefield of the Episcopal Church, of the Tenants and the Edwards and their associates, and of the Reverend Abel Morgan and others of the Baptist Church. Several of these Mr. Hart at this time used to hear and has since professed to have received much benefit from their preaching, particularly from Mr. Whitefield's. Well, Whitefield's stirring gospel proclamation in the spring of 1740 led to Hart's conversion, and Hart would be baptized by Jenkin Jones on April 3rd, 1741. Whitefield had decisively altered Hart's destiny. But as the teenager took the first steps of discipleship in Pennsylvania, Whitefield was off shaping his future further, as well as the future of Southern Baptist, as no one at that time could have guessed. Whitefield revives the Charleston Baptist. Whitefield headed south in the summer of 1740, and on July 7th, he found himself at Ashley Ferry, South Carolina, just 14 miles outside of Charleston. There, Whitefield met Isaac Chandler, who he called a gracious Baptist minister. Chandler was a warm supporter of the revival and invited Whitfield to preach at the Ashley River Meeting House, which he did to the conviction of some and the comfort of others, he reported in his diary. 2 days later, the meeting house could not contain the audience that had gathered to hear Whitfield, so he preached outside under a tree. People seemed to come from all parts, and the word came with convincing power, Whitfield wrote. Whitfield had arrived at the darkest hour for the Charleston Baptist Church, from which the Ashley Ferry congregation had formed. The Charleston Baptist Church was the oldest in the South, having formed in Kittery, Maine in 1682 before relocating to Charleston in 1696. By 1740, when Whitfield was there, the church had been decimated by decades of theological division, ugly property disputes, the departure of some members to form new churches, as in the case with Ashley River, and because of unstable pastoral leadership. The Baptist historian Morgan Edwards reported that during this period, quote, the number of communicants at Charleston was reduced to 3 souls, only 1 man, Mr. Shepherd, and 2 women remaining that might be called a church. In July of 1740, the church's total collapse seemed a real possibility. But Whitfield's preaching tour changed everything. As Basil Manley Sr., who succeeded Richard Furman as the pastor of the Charleston Baptist Church, as Basil Manley Sr. wrote, just in this gloomy crisis, however, it pleased God by the ministry of Mr. Whitfield to revive his work, in the fruits of which the Baptists largely shared and many joined them. The Charleston Church experienced sufficient revival under Whitfield's ministry to press on to the close of the decade, though they were often without a regular pastor during that period. Basil Manley Jr., who was reared in the Charleston Baptist Church, also reflected on this time period, and he summed up Whitfield's impact on the church when he wrote, at this distance of time, it is impossible to trace in detail the results in Charleston, but it is necessary to notice George Whitfield, though not a Baptist, as one of the frequent preachers at our church, and one whose preaching sowed seeds from which subsequent laborers doubtless reaped valuable harvest. Now, such stories of church revitalization are common from Whitfield's biography, but this one should hold a special place in the hearts of Southern Baptists, for the little fellowship preserved in the summer of 1740 would become the mother church of our denomination. Hart's Whitfieldian ministry. Almost a decade later, in October of 1749, Oliver Hart walked into the annual meeting of the Philadelphia Baptist Association. Now 26 years old, Hart earned his living as a carpenter, though in recent years he had felt the pull of ministry and had been licensed to preach. At the meeting, Jenkin Jones, his boyhood pastor, read a letter from the Charleston Baptist, pleading with their northern brethren to send them a worthy minister. Afterward, several men urged Oliver Hart to answer that call. Within 2 months, Hart had closed his carpenter shop, received ordination, and sailed for Charleston. He arrived on December 2nd, 1749, another crisis moment for the Baptist in the South. As Hart stepped off the boat, that man I mentioned earlier, Isaac Chandler, the gracious Baptist minister of Ashley Ferry, he was the last Baptist minister in the region, and he was being buried as Oliver Hart walked into town. But the desperate condition of Southern small s Baptist was about to change. For the next 30 years, the Charleston Baptist Church, and indeed the entire Baptist cause in the South, would flourish under Oliver Hart's spiritual leadership. Looking back, it's clear that Oliver Hart's energetic and successful ministry drew great inspiration from the revival ministry of George Whitfield. David Bevington has identified Hart as one of Whitfield's many Baptist converts who, quote, synthesized Baptist traditions with revival influences, end quote, in the second half of the 18th century. The result of that synthesis in Charleston and elsewhere was, again quoting Bevington, that Baptist life was being revitalized by permeation from the outside, end quote. Whitfield's lively influence is abundantly evident in Hart's preaching, activism, Catholicity, and revivalism. First, we'll consider preaching. J.R. Packer has written that Whitfield's preaching, like his personal faith, centered upon the person of the dear Jesus. And the same could be said for Oliver Hart's preaching. Though Hart's records show that he preached texts from across the canon of Scripture, his goal was always to point sinners to the person and work of Jesus Christ. Hart said, "Let Christ and his gospel be your delightful theme," he once advised young preachers. "Yes, Christ is to be the sum and substance of all your discourses. A little dry morality, however refined, will never feed the minds of your hearers," end quote. Undergirding Hart's gospel message were the same sturdy doctrines of evangelical Calvinism he had heard from Whitfield. The doctrines of free, efficacious grace were precious to him, Furman recalled. Hart was not as dramatic a preacher as Whitfield, but then again, who was? But he was every bit as earnest, the black gown and bands that he wore adding to his gravitas in the pulpit. One listener awakened by Hart's searching gospel preaching was Samuel Stillman, who would later pastor the First Baptist Church of Boston during the Revolutionary years. Stillman was a teenager in the Charleston Baptist Church at this time. After hearing one particularly sobering message from Hart, Stillman wrote, "My mind was again solemnly impressed with a sense of my awful condition as a sinner. The conviction grew stronger and stronger. My condition alarmed me. I saw myself without Christ and without hope. I found that I deserved the wrath to come and that God would be just to send me to hell. I was now frequently on my knees pleading for mercy. As a beggar I went, having nothing but guilt and no plea but mercy." It was just a few days later that the gospel's light broke through to Stillman. This time it was through another Oliver Hart sermon, this time from Matthew 1:21, "And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." This time Stillman's biographer tells the story. He writes, "From this sermon, Stillman received consolation. And Stillman added," now these are his words, "Christ then became precious to me, yea, all in all. Then I could say of wisdom, her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. That, I still think, was the day of my espousal. Glory be to God for the riches of his grace to me. Why me, Lord?" And so on and so on. End quote. Stillman's biographer said he was soon after baptized and received into the church under the pastoral care of Mr. Hart. Now, Stillman's experience under Hart's ministry was not uncommon. As it had been for Whitfield, Hart's goal was not only to enlighten the minds of his listeners, though he was deeply concerned about teaching sound doctrine, but Hart desired to grip the hearts of his listener. As Hart's contemporary William Rogers remembered, "As a preacher, Hart's manner was pleasing and his delivery animated. Speaking from the heart, it was his aim that the hearts of those who heard him might always be benefited." We get a sampling of the heartfelt preaching of Oliver Hart in a diary entry from 1754. He wrote, "Blessed be God, had a good day today. Preached twice with some degree of warmth. In the afternoon, from John 3:7, ye must be born again. I felt my soul drawn out after the conversion of sinners. Oh, that they knew what the new birth means." I hear echoes of George Whitfield there. As Sarah Edwards had once said of Whitfield, "Hart preached from a heart all aglow with love." Of course, this type of preaching required significant spiritual preparation. Hart's diaries often show him in prayer, asking for the Spirit's help to, quote, "feel his subject," and that he might preach with power, warmth, and freedom. Hart also followed Whitfield in drawing out the gospel's ethical implications from the pulpit. Charleston's cosmopolitan society was notorious for its hedonistic devotion to the theater, dancing, and gaming. In a 1740 visit, you all may know, Whitfield had chastised the Anglican commissary Alexander Garden for not, quote, "exclaiming against the assemblies and the balls here," end quote. Well, Oliver Hart accepted that challenge. In a sermon, dancing exploded. A sermon showing the unlawfulness, sinfulness, and bad consequences of balls, assemblies, and dances in general. Hart said in that sermon, "I am determined in faithfulness to my trust to maintain an open and vigorous war with all the vices and sinful diversions of the age." Hart knew that to speak pointedly about popular sins was to invite ridicule and opposition, as Whitfield had experienced throughout his ministry. And yet, quote, "be this as it may, it gives me little or no concern. If I had not been willing to endure the scoff of the world, I should never have made an open profession of the religion of Jesus, much less should I have become a preacher of his much despised gospel. Dancing Exploded was Hart's most widely read sermon. What about activism? Whitfield has been called a restless, energetic activist, happy only when burning the candle at both ends. Whitfield once prayed, "Keep me traveling, keep me working, or at least beginning to begin to work for thee till I die." Well, as with Whitfield, Hart's spirituality was expressed in vigorous activity for God. The recurring prayer of Hart's diaries, "Lord, may I lay out my strength for thee," could serve as the theme of his ministry. When he was not preaching, Hart could be found busily pursuing such activities as writing letters to Northern Baptist brethren, organizing and leading the Charleston Baptist Association, which he founded in 1751, editing the Charleston Confession of Faith, an adaptation of the Philadelphia Confession and the London Confession in 1769, or co-writing the Manual of Church Discipline in 1773 for the association. He could be found establishing a minister's education fund and training young pastors in his home, raising funds for and recruiting the first missionary for the association, or rallying local churches to contribute to the fledgling Rhode Island College, building bridges between regular and separate Baptists in the area, working for religious liberty under the new state constitution, or traveling the backcountry of South Carolina to garner support for the Patriot cause on assignment from the state government. Hart also, in his spare time, maintained a wide-ranging itinerant ministry, taking evangelistic forays everywhere from nearby island communities to Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Hart once wrote home to his father after one of these trips, "I am still trying to labor for God as enabled, but I find I come short of that engagedness which I could desire. Souls are precious. Otherwise, the Lord would not have done so much for their salvation as he has done. And can I trifle with them? God forbid. I would fain be made instrumental in bringing many souls home to Jesus Christ." Hart's life and writings express that hallmark of evangelical piety, a passionate desire to be useful to the Lord. Consequently, any perceived laxity in his service could send Hart into deep spiritual depression, as expressed in this diary entry. He wrote, "I do this morning feel myself under a sense of my barrenness. Alas, what do I do for God? I am indeed employed in his vineyard, but I feel to little purpose. I feel the want of the life and power of religion in my own heart. This causes such a languor and faintness in all my duties to God. This makes me such a poor manager of my time. Alas, I am frequently upon my bed when I ought to be upon my knees. To my shame, sometimes the sun appears in the horizon and begins his daily course before I've paid my tribute of praise to God. And perhaps while I am indulging myself in inactive slumbers upon my bed, oh, wretched stupidity, oh, that for time to come I may be more active for God." On the other hand, nothing made Hart's soul sore like knowing he was engaged in the Lord's service, no matter how taxing it may be. Hart sounds very much like Whitfield when, at the end of one especially exhausting day, he blissfully wrote, "Blessed be God, I can say, although I am at times weary in my Lord's work, yet I am not weary of it, and I hope I never shall." Catholicity. Whitfield once wrote to the Presbyterian Ralph Erskine, "Though I profess myself a minister of the Church of England, I am of a Catholic spirit. And if I see any man who loves the Lord Jesus in sincerity, I am not very solicitous to what outward communion he belongs." And this same big-hearted Catholicity marked Oliver Hart's ministry in Charleston. This is illustrated by an episode recorded in a 1754 diary entry. He writes, "In the evening, I buried a child in the Anglican church burying ground and spoke extemporaneously, perhaps the first instance of this nature ever known in this province. The church minister was sick and could not attend himself, therefore gave me free liberty to speak in my own way, which discovered an extraordinary Catholic spirit. Oh, that all bigotry was rooted out of the earth! Then would there subsist a greater harmony between persons than what does. It is indeed a pity that our little outward differences should cause such a shyness between us." Hart befriended local ministers from across the denominational spectrum. He took counsel from the Presbyterian minister John Zubley and dined with the Methodist missionary Joseph Pilmore. Pilmore described Hart as not only sensible but truly evangelical and very devout. Hart enjoyed an especially close friendship with the congregational pastor William Tennant III. Hart and Tennant worked closely together in the revolutionary years, raising support for the Patriot cause and petitioning the colonial government for religious liberty under the new Constitution. When Tennant died in 1777, Hart preached an affectionate memorial sermon for his friend in the Baptist meeting house. Hart's assessment of Tennant's Catholicity is suggestive of his own views. Here's what he wrote about Tennant. "It may not be amiss to observe that his religious sentiments were open, free, and generous, built upon principles of true Catholicism, not influenced by bigotry or party spirit. He thought that religion should be left entirely free and that there should be no manner of constraint upon the conscience. He was of opinion that there was a wise providence in permitting people to think differently about modes of worship, and therefore he valued good men of every denomination." Hart's Catholicity is further demonstrated in his expressions of love for non-Baptist evangelical leaders like the older Tennants. And Hart grew up just miles from that log college at Neshaminy Creek. Samuel Davies, and of course George Whitfield. It seems Hart was not only aware of a growing, broader evangelical movement, but that he personally and deeply identified with it. Yet for all his open-heartedness, Hart remained a cheerfully convictional Baptist. In one of his later letters to Richard Furman, Hart insisted on opening the Lord's table only to those who had been immersed as believers. Hart knew this was a dividing line among evangelicals, recalling with some amusement that, quote, "the great and good Mr. Whitfield once exclaimed, 'These Anabaptists are stealing sheep. They wash my sheep and they fleece my sheep.'" Yet Hart was able to hold his biblical convictions without bitterness. Before closing his letter, he wrote, "I hope nothing that I've said will be construed into bigotry or the want of Christian regard to paedo-Baptist. I think the whole tenor of my conduct acquits me from such a charge. I sincerely declare that I esteem a number of paedo-Baptists as Christians in preference to many Baptists, and could freely commune with them at the Lord's table if my master did not forbid by making baptism an essential prerequisite to church membership. With regard to our paedo-Baptist brethren, I wish them well and forbid them not, though they walk not with us." Revival. Perhaps Whitfield's mark is seen most clearly in Hart's commitment to revival. In current discussions of Southern Baptist origins, I think this is often overlooked. The so-called Charleston tradition, which Hart represents, is often characterized by its concern for the orderliness of the Puritans, while the, quote, Sandy Creek tradition of the separate Baptists is said to be marked by their spiritual ardor that came from the Great Awakening. Yet, Hart's personal writings reveal that he never got over his spiritual experience during the height of the Great Awakening. From his earliest journal entries to his final letters, revival remained a constant topic of conversation and prayer. As he once wrote to Isaac Backus, "My soul longs for the downpouring of the Spirit amongst us, that we may have an ingathering of many souls. For this I crave your interest at the throne of grace." In 1754, Hart and the Charleston Baptists experienced just such an awakening. His diary from August to October of that year is filled with accounts of the young people earnestly seeking salvation. On an almost nightly basis, the youth came and begged Hart to address them with the gospel and counsel them in their spiritual distress. These meetings, often held in private homes, were marked by unusual solemnity. After one such gathering, Hart wrote, "Blessed be God who hath enabled me this day to speak his word with some degree of power, and I trust blessed it to some. In the evening met the society at Mr. Baker's. Many were gathered together. I made the suffering and death of Christ the subject of my discourse. Several were melted down into tears. Lord, carry on thy work among us." At certain points of the revival, Hart's passionate preaching raised the affections of his hearers to the point of physical manifestations, as when a group of young people came to Hart's house by night. As he counseled them, he remembered some complained and cried out under a sense of the desperate wickedness and corruption of their own hearts, of which they had such a deep sense that they seemed to study to find out such words to express themselves concerning it, as might set it forth in the strongest forms. Some were crying out under a sense of sin. Never were such a company of great sinners met together in the world, if they themselves might be judges. But the most of them were crying out for Jesus Christ. Oh, give me Christ. Give me Christ. Oh, if I had but Christ. Hart concluded his account of the 1754 revival with the report of 10 young people receiving baptism after satisfactory examination. The 1754 Charleston revival helps us place Hart and the Charleston Baptists squarely in what Thomas Kidd has called the Long Great Awakening. Kidd has identified many important widespread revivals in America after that first burst of spiritual life under Whitfield in 1740 to 1743, all the way up to the close of the 18th century. During this period, Kidd argues, a new evangelical movement was born in America, one that was marked by, quote, persistent desires for revival, widespread individual conversions, and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. I think it would be difficult to find a more fitting description for the spirituality of Oliver Hart. Well, as we've seen, Whitfield served as something of a spiritual guide for Hart in his teenage years, and then as a model for his ministry in Charleston. But during the years 1750 to 1770, Whitfield also played another role in Hart's life, that of gospel partner, working with Whitfield. Kidd has noted the significant yet underappreciated role that local pastors in colonial America played in supporting Whitfield's itinerant ministry. It should not surprise us that when Whitfield came to Charleston after 1750, when Hart was there, that Oliver Hart supported and on occasion assisted the grand itinerant in the greater evangelical cause. Three sources from this period link the two ministers working together. The first is John Gano, the gifted Baptist preacher of the latter 18th century. In March of 1755, Gano had undertaken an itinerant missionary campaign into the southern colonies from his home in New Jersey. When he stopped in Charleston, Hart offered his pulpit to the young preacher. It proved to be an unforgettable invitation. As Gano remembered, "Mr. Hart spread word among the people that I was to preach. I went with my tattered garb on, and when I rose to speak, the sight of so numerous and brilliant an audience, among whom were 12 ministers and one of whom, in the Charleston Baptist Meeting House, was Mr. Whitfield. For a moment, this brought the fear of man on me. But blessed be the Lord, I was soon relieved from this embarrassment. The thought passed from my mind, I had none to fear and obey but the Lord." Gano's story is a compelling slice of Baptist history for a number of reasons. But for our purposes, it places Whitfield and Hart worshiping together at the Baptist Meeting House in Charleston. The second source linking Whitfield and Hart comes from Whitfield's own hand in a letter dated March 3, 1755. A female correspondent, Mrs. C., had written to Whitfield for spiritual counsel after hearing him preach. Whitfield's response was to commend her to the ministry of Oliver Hart. "I would have you write to Mr. Hart by the bearer, who is an experimental Baptist preacher from the northward. Oh, that he may say something that may do my dear family some good." We know that Whitfield took great care with the souls of men and women, and in Hart he had found a worthy ally in the sacred calling. Well, Whitfield was, of course, in and out of Charleston with some frequency in the remaining 15 years of his life. It is likely that he maintained regular contact with Hart during these visits, though to what extent we do not know. What we do know from our third and final source is that their final collaboration in ministry proved to be their most fruitful. The date was March 4, 1770, and Whitfield was preaching in Charleston for the last time. On this occasion, a former slave named John Morant wandered up, planning with a friend to cause trouble. But as had happened so many times before, the scoffer experienced deep conviction under Whitfield's proclamation. So powerfully was Morant struck that he fell to the ground unable to move. He was carried to the vestry, where Whitfield later visited him, saying, "Jesus Christ has got thee at last." Morant was then carried home and committed to a sickbed. But before Whitfield left Charleston, he first asked Oliver Hart to go see Morant. And Morant picks up the story from there. "On the fourth day, the minister, Mr. Whitfield, had desired to visit me, came to see me. And being directed upstairs, when he entered the room, I thought he made my distress much worse. He wanted to take hold of my hand, but I durst not give it to him. He insisted upon taking hold of it, and then I got away from him on the other side of the bed. But being very weak, I fell down. And before I could recover, he came to me and took me by the hand, and he lifted me up, and after a few words desired to go to prayer. So he fell upon his knees and pulled me down also. After he had spent some time in prayer, he rose up and asked me now how I did. I answered, 'Much worse.' He then said, 'Come, we'll have the old thing over again.' So we kneeled down a second time. And after he had prayed earnestly, we got up and he said again, 'How do you do now?' I replied, 'Worse and worse,' and asked him if he intended to kill me. 'No, no,' said he, 'you are worth 1,000 dead men. Let us try the old thing over again.' And so falling upon our knees, he continued in prayer a considerable time. And near the close of his prayer, the Lord was pleased to set my soul at perfect liberty. And being filled with joy, I began to praise the Lord immediately. My sorrows were turned into peace and joy and love. The minister said, "How is it now?" I answered, "All is well, all happy." He then took his leave of me, but called every day for several days afterward. And the last time he said, "Hold fast what thou hast already obtained till Jesus Christ has come." Well, Whitfield would die in Newburyport, Massachusetts, 6 months later. But the fruit of this final act of joint ministry with Hart would endure. Marat began ministering to slaves around Charleston before traveling to London, where in 1785 he received ordination at the Countess of Huntington's Bath Chapel. From there, Marat carried the gospel to a black loyalist community in Nova Scotia. Marat's published narrative of his life went through some 15 editions. Conclusion. Over the course of his remarkable ministry, George Whitfield influenced countless lives with the gospel he preached. For Southern Baptists, none of these is more significant in our history than Oliver Hart. This can be illustrated by the place where we gather today. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary was founded in 1859 by four courageous and visionary professors, two of whom were reared at Charleston's First Baptist Church, James Pettigrew Boyce and Basil Manley Jr. The seminary, which has since trained an army of Southern Baptist ministers, can trace its roots back to the humble query that Hart made to the Charleston Association in 1757, whether there could not be some method concluded upon to furnish, with suitable degree of learning, those among us who appear to have promising gifts for the ministry. The fund which the association went on to establish, of which Hart became treasurer, was the first partnership for theological education among Baptists in America. Indeed, the Southern Baptist Convention itself is an outgrowth of that little collection of four South Carolina churches Hart first assembled as the Charleston Association in 1751. The closer one looks at Southern Baptist life, the clearer the fingerprints of Oliver Hart come into view. And the closer we have looked at Hart, the clearer we have seen the fingerprints of George Whitfield. On this 300th anniversary of Whitfield's birth, it is a great honor for this Southern Baptist to add my voice to the many who give thanks to God for his life. Though he now rests from his labors, his works do follow him. Thank you.